Welcome to Sovereign Mind radio program, and I'm your host, Sonia Barrett, broadcasting from Inner Light Radio on Wednesday, March 26, 2008, Matrix Time. Join me each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time as Sovereign Mind explores the nature of the game, the game players, and the strategies in place to hold you spellbound and distracted. Informed guests will bring insight to the silent side of corporations, spiritual concepts, science, and technology, and how they're all being used to influence your choices. We want you to participate by calling in at 310-928-7733 or emailing your questions to innerlightradio@yahoo.com. My guest today is Michael Tesarian. Michael is back for a part two, and he gave us such amazing information 2 weeks ago and sort of left us hanging, so we had to have him back. Michael is the author, he's an author, public speaker, conspiracy theorist, historian, whose topics include religion, symbolism, sidereal astrology, mythology, the occult, and Atlantis. Michael has written a number of books such as Atlantis, Alien Visitation, and Genetic Manipulation, 2004, produced and presented a six-part DVD, 60-hour series titled Origins and Oracles, which explores ancient mysteries and forbidden knowledge, and is also the co-creator of Time Gnosis, Personal Time Scope Systems. Michael also supports the conspiracy theory that the United States presidency has always been and still remains a tool of the European Royal House, the Freemasons, the Vatican, and a mysterious Egyptian Black Pope. Michael, I would love to welcome you back to the show, and if you will say hello to all of us.
Yes, Sonia, hi. Thank you for having me again. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, you know, there's so many questions from the last time. I was going over all of it, and I thought, okay, what do I ask him first? You know, it's like I could spend all week asking you questions. Let's see. The last time we talked, you went over, you talked about the ties between the Vatican and the creation of Islam. That's just one of the questions that I wanted to get into a little bit. And the British royal family, wanted to talk a little bit more about your book, 2012, The Future of Mankind, for those who have not gone to your site or who have not seen the book. So I want to go into quite a few of those things. Again, I want to remind the audience that you are listening to Sovereign Mind, and our guest is Michael Tesarian. Well, Michael, one of the things I wanted to address the last time, and I didn't get a chance to, and I think this is real important, could you just give us a briefing as to your humble beginnings with all of this? What really led you in this direction? Because I know you started out very, very young.
That's a really good question. Let me ask you, can you hear me okay?
Is volume good? Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's
a loaded question.
It's so multifaceted. It's hard to say because, you know, I've also looked at the reasons as why that might be. I've also looked at, you know, my motivation, why, especially in the area of conspiracy, why, you know, I'd be motivated to, in a way, you know, bring this kind of knowledge in front of people when all it brings you is a lot of difficulty in life and all these kinds of things. And yet it just seems that something motivates me to do that. So, you know, I don't really have any answers as to how I got into it. It's just a questioning, I guess.
When did the curiosity come about? Probably, I think that might be the thing, because I know people ask me that question and it's really hard because I feel like I was born that way. But it's sort of, you know, was there a particular moment in time where it just sort of something triggered you, or it was just an unfolding?
I think it was around about when I was, I know for sure that it was about 13 years of age when I started to consider a lot, that basically a lot of stuff that I'd been told, was not accurate. And my family always brought me up to at least believe that about academica, but it was, you know, or at least about the mainstream teachings. I'd always known from them that, you know, to doubt and to trust and to read and to study and all of these kinds of things. But it was really about also, you know, me also waking up to even discovering that even a lot of what my family was telling me about what to believe or what to know or even their way of looking at life also was not particularly correct. You know, it was more along, it was more a process between the ages of 13, say, to like, 18, that sort of individuated my own understanding and start to stop looking to any authority, including members of my own family in a way. And some of them, you see, work within the, you know, the New Age movement. Some of them had reputations. Some of them had written books, you know, so you could easily live in their shadow, you know, for the rest of your life thinking they've got all the answers or whatever, you know. So basically, I was always very individualized. And my mentors were mostly people like, you know, C.S. Lewis and George MacDonald and J.R.R. Tolkien and things like this. I turned to books mostly. Particularly those three authors and, you know, others, of course, of great importance, like, you know, Khalil Gibran and Mikhail Naimi from Persia, of course, from the Lebanon, all sorts of poets and, you know, a huge, I was always, you know, pretty well read. So, you know, Thomas Hardy and D.H. Lawrence within ordinary literature, you know, and things like that, Philip Larkin in poetry, Sylvia Plath, you know, so suddenly the whole world of knowledge opened up and you start to realize that nobody, no one person has all the answers, and that the best thing that you can do is have a very open and inquisitive mind and continue to seek for the truth without actually trying to say that you've found it, you know? Just continue the process.
It's a continuous quest, right?
It's a continuous quest, and it takes you through many areas, you know? I mean, to answer your question more specifically, I would say that it happened. The biggest sort of question mark, now looking back, a thing that really helped open the door to where I am now would probably have been my studies into what was, you know, a subliminal art or subliminally encoded messages within the media. This is, you know, within ad copy, of course, but it's also within television commercials and so on. From about 14, 15, I started to really assiduously study magazines and ad copy and, you know, Madison Avenue sort of, you know, press releases, this kind of thing, and started to notice many occult motifs in it. So this sort of practicalized my knowledge of occult matters. And for your audience who may be, you know, shuddering with fear as soon as they hear, you know, the word occult, they've got to realize that there's nothing sinister about that word. It just means the hidden. It just means something that mankind is not made privy to. And that a student of the occult doesn't need to be an occultist. A student of the occult is somebody who may be trying to find out what kind of occult knowledge is being used against the human race. I mean, this pretty much defines my entire work within the conspiracy movement, is I'm just a person who studies hidden, secretive matters so that I can find out, you know, who's using it against the rest of mankind, because we are, in, as we said before, in a situation of psychic dictatorship, in which there is a war on consciousness. My first introduction to it was, you know, through literature and also through art. So I owe art a great deal. In fact, a new book I'm putting together, you know, I was writing and suddenly I ended up sort of dipping into that and reminding myself of just how much I owe, even, you know, the medieval painters and how much of my life, you know, came to where I am now by studying, you know, the Pre-Raphaelites and all sorts of other, you know, artists and these medieval artists. And then, of course, we have now modern graphic artists, tremendously skilled, highly adept, brilliant imaginations. We only have to look at the TV graphics. We only have to look at the TV inserts, you know, the previews to movies. We only have to look at the skill within the movie industry to recognize that there's an enormous talent there. But it's like I've always said, the talent that brings your soul to a higher place, a purer place, a more elevated place, is also the talent and the genius and the ability that can bring your soul down if it's in the hands of people who want to do that. So just because it's great skill and you know, very attractive aesthetically and all of these kinds of things, there's a symbolic language that's being used. And this is the symbolic language of the adepts of old. So it wouldn't concern me in the slightest if just well-meaning artists, well-meaning institutions were just, you know, hard at it, you know, making artwork, making movies, making ads, making billboards, making, you know, logos and all sorts of things, just using random symbolism that, you know, they had a sort of a genius or capacity with. But unfortunately, from the time of 13 years old, I was able to prove to at least my satisfaction that that's not the all, the be end and all to it, because in fact, they're dipping into an archive that is actually very sacred. They're dipping into an archive that's many thousands of years old, that is religiously and spiritually based, and they're using these symbols that once had a great meaning for our forefathers in a spiritual context within their religions of the ancient world, within the spiritual beliefs of the ancient world. And these symbols are turning up in modern corporate, commercial, you know, kinds of areas where they don't belong.
Right.
And they don't belong there because, you see, unfortunately, you can't really put a mystical spiritual symbolism or color or emblem or number system or whatever. There's lots of things that they do. Onto something like a bar of soap or merely a toothpaste packet and just hope that nothing's going to happen except that your product's going to sell out. It's not quite as simple as that. Symbols that resonate with our unconscious mind, with our DNA, with our race memory, that were worshipped for millennia. I mean, this is just a simple fact. You don't have to like it. You don't have to like the fact that this has happened, but it just happens to be a scientifically provable fact that that which has been worshipped, that which has been adored for thousands of years, it's like an average man's modern love of his flag.
He's not going to want to see that language. Flag. I mean, symbols are really the language, the language, but they try to infuse it with their own thought process.
Good point.
I want to make sure that our audience realizes that this is not a recorded program. This is live. So I want to say again to participate by sending your emails to innerlightradio@yahoo.com, or you may call in at 310-928-7733. And again, we are speaking with Michael Tesserian. Yes, Michael, I love what the emphasis you do put on symbols, because I noticed that in your work, and that's something that needs to be realized, everything that you just said. Symbols tell the story. They tell such a deep story, and when you don't realize it and you're absorbing symbols all day long, which is really what we're doing, like you said, with the billboards, with the advertising, with television, it's everywhere. Let's see. Yeah, I want to ask you, right when the show was ending the last time, you were talking about the ties between the Vatican and was it the creation of Islam, creation of Israel? I wanted you to go into that a little bit more, if you would.
Well,
in relationship to now, that's one reason why I kind of wanted you to talk about it with all the madness that's going on.
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, in my reading of history, and we don't even have to go back very far, it's quite clear that there's something unusual. That there's been a slow building up to this point. This is not just something that has, you know, come out of the blue. It's part of a very long, deliberate journey of people that are now known in the media as neocons, but that's a very new terminology for a coterie, you know, that has slowly itself gained a lot of power. This is a coterie that is connected very much to the Zionist movement, and we have to distinguish that from, you know, people thinking, okay, it's a Jewish organization. It's actually not a Jewish organization when you really get into the nitty-gritty of it. But to all intents and purposes, this Zionist movement, you see, is identical with, to all intents and purposes, as the neoconservative movement. This is what people also have to get around. And it just like Nazi Germany, didn't just appear overnight. There was warning signs from even generations before, you see. Just as Nazi Germany got created because the powers that be created the circumstances for such a, you know, radical and outrageous thing to happen, the way that Europe had been divided, the way certain, you know, embargoes and restrictions had been placed on Germany, you know, before the rise of the Nazis, etc. So whenever you have a crisis, you have to realize to look back into history a little bit. And when you do so, you'll start to find that there is a tremendously slow, you know, and deliberate process. So it's not just about 9/11, oh my goodness, look what somebody out there has done to us, and we need to immediately react. My God, if it was only as simple as that, you know, I'd be first in line. But unfortunately, you have to discover that, you know, there's a tremendous tie-in with the Zionist movement to 9/11. There's an amazing tie-in between the neoconservatives who've wanted to push America not just into a conflict in the Middle East. That they could have done much easier than even having this disaster. The disaster of 9/11 is, and what's been going on recently, you see, is for a much larger purpose. It's actually to do with the destruction of America, period. One way of getting to that objective, you see, is to get American people involved in foreign wars. I mean, there's lots of other reasons why. There's at least a four or five other reasons, you see. And oil, I'm not saying that oil is not one of those reasons. Of course it is. But there are many other important reasons that we go into in our work, you know, to try and show people that it's not just a question of oil. It's not just a question of retaliation against some unknown, you know, terrorist organization that nobody had ever heard of, but it just popped up out of the blue, that wasn't even on the list of America's, you know, in fact, the American government and the world intelligence community never even heard of Al-Qaeda. And in fact, even if you track back a certain amount of time, even the Taliban were not even on the list of dangerous terrorist organizations. This is within just about, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. Neither of these groups even were on an intelligence list of any, you know, dimension talking about terrorist threats. And yet all of a sudden, in the post-Bush eras, we suddenly have these major threats. I mean, how can this be? Then when you dig a little bit deeper, you suddenly find out that this great bugbear, this new Goliath, you know, this new threat, Al-Qaeda, is actually created by the very neocons, the very Zionist coterie operating out of New York City. To people in the conspiracy movement, Sonia, this is an old, old story. This is not something that takes us by surprise anymore. Because when you discover how the Federal Reserve got created back in the 1920s, you see, when you discover how the First and Second World War were orchestrated, when you discover how many of the other imbroglios and wars were created, it all comes back to this. When you study the rise of Bolshevism in Russia in the 1919, you see, and the murder of the Tsar and his family, and the rising of communist Russia, and the splitting of Europe into these zones of communism, all of this kind of thing, even the funding of Adolf Hitler, can be tracked back to New York and to London. So now
yes,
that we
I
find,
see that. Yeah, I saw yeah. that in your writing, mentioning the Al Qaeda being the brainchild of the Vatican and the funding of Hitler through a London-based what is it, intelligence?
Yeah. These are all just in the same way that Europe itself was divided. So what we have to understand first, when we talk about places like Iraq, Iran, you know, Kuwait, is that those are pretty artificial demarcations, actually. The boundaries of these countries was laid down after the First and Second World War. Let's just take the First World War with Winston Churchill. The Second World War with Hitler, Winston Churchill, and so on. When Turkey and Germany were allies, a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people are very, very important to realize that Nazi Germany had allies. It didn't just fight on its own. It didn't just have allies with the Japanese. It had allies with the Turks from Turkey. It had allies with Croatia. The Croatians and by the way, just as an interesting point, that if people think the crimes of the Nazi soldiers were bad or German soldiers were bad, they better check in to Croatian massacres and genocide and horrors of unimaginable proportions. But you see, Germany had allies. And by the way, Germany had allies with Arab concerns, Syria, I think, and Jordan, you see, and also Egypt. They were very, very strongly allied to the elite of Egypt. There's a tremendous study of the connections between Nazi Germany going back before the war to the caliphs and to the Pashas of the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Ottoman Empire. It needs to be studied. You can just open an encyclopedia mm-hmm. and start reading up on this, or contact me. I'll send information to people.
Mm-hmm.
And with Egypt. Now, of course, we know that the Nazis, the Germans, and we know that all these other, you know, allies didn't win. They lost the war. So what do you think happened to their countries? What do you think happened within? Just like today, we have divisions within America. Well, within these countries, all these allied countries of the First and Second World War, you had countries that were deeply, had factions within their own countries that were deeply, you know, in hatred of each other. So when the British and the American side, quote-unquote, won, all those people who had supported Britain and America within those, you know, foreign countries, both Middle Eastern and European, were now in the ascendancy. And those who had supported Nazi Germany, you see, and Turkey, and who basically had lost, were now completely thrown out of power within their own countries. They became, you know, the pariahs within their own country. So there was huge changes of the status quo, huge changes of the political matrix within these countries of Egypt, of Turkey. In fact, the crumbling of the entire, what's called the Ottoman Empire, happened because of this war. Germany suffered the establishment of new boundaries, new borders, where the demagogues just sat around and basically chopped up the spoils of war, you see, and this includes countries. This included the mobilization of, you know, millions of human beings in Europe. This is all within very recent history. This is all within one generation back, you know, so our own fathers and mothers lived through this time. It's not a lot of, we're not talking ancient history here. You know, we're talking about extremely recent times that just predate where we are at this point. Kuwait, for instance, didn't even exist. Kuwait is a complete concoction of the last, you know, 50 or so years, in which, and again, it's a concoction from Britain. Britain decided. Britain was the, had won the war. And so just like in the period before the First World War, where they were so harsh on Germany, the harshness of France and the harshness of England to oppress the German people gave rise to an Adolf Hitler that then sparked the Second World War. It wasn't Hitler that created the Second World War. It was the people who had oppressed Germany, hoping for such a, you know, a right-wing reaction within the country politically. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. That gave them the perfect right to go in there and bomb Germany out of, you know, existence. And there might be reasons why they would have wanted to do that. So we have the same thing now moving further east. There's been an antipathy towards the Arab people, but that antipathy was not natural to England, and it was certainly not natural to America. It's been manufactured in the last so long, you know, maybe, let's take it back even maybe 20 years or so. But you can better believe that England and America always had very, very positive connections with Arab countries, very, very good connections with Arab countries for many decades. And they tried to maintain that. Of course, the problem was the rising of the State of Israel. The State of Israel is basically a fascist organization. It is a racist state, and it has a racist political policy. And unfortunately, the lobbyists, the Zionist lobbyists, have misled the Israeli people, Jewish people, who suffer incredibly, and they suffer from. Not only that, but they suffer from bad press. They suffer from people in the world, you know, just despising the actions of these few elites that then the rest of the Jewish people are being blamed for. They may be a reaction coming, you see, to these Zionist crimes. What happens if, again, there's a rising in certain nations of right-wing factions who are either funded or just of their own bat get so fed up, you see, with the actions of these Zionists. But they mistake that this, they're thinking it's all Jewish people believe this and rise up against the Jewish people again in the cities of the world. Not just in Israel, but right in the normal cities of the world. Why? That's horrible. That would be terrible. But this is the lesson of history.
Yeah.
And the Zionists up in New York City, and the Zionists working alongside the Queen, and the Zionist agents and ambassadors who are sitting taking orders from, you know, the Pope. And when I say the Pope, I mean the people that also control the Pope, the Black Pope. And the people mm-hmm. that you know are in control of Vatican, and it's not who we think it is. It's not the obvious mm-hmm. obvious people, but these people who have tremendous power, they will not be hurt. They will not be harmed, and they will not be hurt. It'll be the ordinary people, the ordinary Christian, the ordinary Jew, the ordinary Muslim, you see, who are in the pickle, and that is exactly what is brewing at this point in time.
Wow, that's a lot brewing. And the thing is all of what you just spoke of ties obviously right into what you have been talking about, which is with the British royal family and these powerful dynasties, these bloodlines that you had mentioned before, coming out of, you said Venice, you know, 1500 BC and Egypt, Dragon Court. I mean, all of this, it's such a, there's no word to describe it because it is such a large ball of so much that it's like, where do you begin? Because it dates so far back. All of this is coming from so far back. And I kind of wanted you to talk a little bit about those maybe dynasties, in relation to, I know you just mentioned some of that, but in relation to all of this, those that are dating that far back, such as, the Dragon Court or Brotherhood of the Snake. A lot of people haven't heard of these orders or secret societies. A lot of people don't realize the ambulance, and what is it, the Hospitallers, that these were actually, orders or secret societies, or just like Knights Templar.
Exactly. Just in the same way that we've talked about these, you know, political, henchmen who work like little ants for higher concerns. So when you walk around your town today and you see, you know, police stations, jails, you know, certain right. government buildings, and certainly banks, banking is very much involved in the history of the Knights Templar. They were among the first great bankers of the world. Of course, we know that there was others as well, that banking was used in lots of countries, but the style of Western banking that's used today has an origin, a date of birth. The economic systems do. Many of the think tank schools, many of the stately flags and emblems all come from these ancient times. This is why you will see reference when, say, I'll give you just one example. Prince Charles was being crowned. Of course, he was being crowned, you know, Prince of Wales by his mother. And then why, if it's so unimportant, why would his mother be saying to him, he sits on a chair, I believe, that had a dragon motif. And, of course, being Prince of Wales, they have the dragon flag. The emblem of Wales is the flag. Which has a dragon on it. And so the queen says, by the power of this dragon, do you rule? You are ruling because you're given power by this dragon. I mean, you know, again, we're talking symbolism here. So we have, we have dragons on the Scottish flag. We have dragons in the city of London. People who go for a tour of the city of London will see that the city itself, you can't get into it unless you pass, you know, through a road, a gateway that has dragon motifs on it. You get dragon motifs at the Vatican. And you've got dragon motifs when you hear about St. Patrick casting out the serpents from Ireland and so on. So rather than just, you know, have a knee-jerk reaction to say, well, it must be something to do with evil then, let's forget about it. People need to understand that a lot of the royal dynasties, of course, there's a lot of royal dynasties, and again, it's a sort of a myth that people think that these aristocratic concerns have just folded up and disappeared off the face of the earth. We believe this, of course, because, you know, today we only see mostly the middle class and the working class, and we believe the lie that the upper classes are basically sort of just faded away after the war, you know, that society changed and the aristocratics, people faded away. I mean, you have to know that that's a lie, because all you have to look at is British government, in which they have a House of Lords. And the House of Lords is very powerful still. It's not just something that people go on tourist, you know, take a photograph of. These people are tremendously powerful. So you have the House of Commons, which is the common people. That's the, you know, they're considered the underlings, the people who don't understand anything. They can have the House of Commons. But when any bill or any law is ever passed, it passes also through the House of Lords. They make the final decisions on things. And even if you look at the House of Commons itself, there's some worrying aspects. Right where the speaker sits, anybody turns on, you know, one of the channels in America, I can't remember which one it is, but they'll show you clips of the morning where they show you the British House of Commons. What do you see sitting in front of the speaker? Is the Queen's standard, the Queen's mace, or what they call the Queen's, you know, scepter. The scepter. I mean, nobody sits down in Parliament. The Parliament opens with a royal ritual. So what's going on here, you know? Yeah, so these guys, and then we're saying, no, the Queen has no say, you know, it's nothing. Yeah, listen, these royal families run it from the shop to the top. Oh, now, yeah. just to again, start at the beginning and qualify terms, The term Brotherhood of the Snake is a term that was coined by an author called William Bramley, whose work I very much recommend, and he wrote a book called The Gods of Eden. And this book has inspired me in my work. It's also...
it's a great book. Yeah, yes, I read it years ago.
And so, again, these are just what you would call... these are just euphemisms. You know, one can come up with so many names. And this order, this great order that we're talking about, this black nobility, has been referred to by many terms. People shouldn't so much get hooked on the terms, but they're just for convenience. But the term Brotherhood of the Snake was coined by William Bramley. The term Dragon Court is to be found in the works of Lawrence Gardner. He actually claims he's from the Dragon Court. That's why he came up with the name. He claims to be descended from the Stuarts or something of England or whatever. And that name is very, very appropriate. Black nobility, you know, is a term first used by Dr. John Coleman. It's actually a term used by the black nobility themselves, actually, in the 1500s as well. So there's lots of different terms for these people. They can be referred to as an oligarchy. And an oligarchy is a power elite. You can also use the word plutocracy, timarchy. There's different words for these people. Oligarchy, plutocracy, people who think that they're a cut above everybody else. People who, you know, believe that they've got a destiny to rule the world as gods. This is what Christians have to realize when they study this, is because you're dealing with a coterie who don't really accept God as the normal Bible reading Christian will accept God, or as the Torah reading Jew will accept God. They think of themselves as God. They may not admit that, of course, because they know what fate will befall them should they openly admit this. But believe me, in their own minds, and into the minds of the people who serve these people, they are gods. They are demigods.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, they consider themselves a superior intelligence. Which is, you know, obviously what determines what they do with the rest of society, because the rest of society holds no importance in intelligence or in genetic, what should I say? Genetic, you know, the same thing. So if you're not up there as far as being a superior, being part of that bloodline, you basically are worthless, an empty shell, a slave.
Yeah, like Kissinger said, you're just useless eaters. You're just useless eaters.
Exactly. Basically, and that's exactly how they do see the rest of the world. And people have to understand when we say, how could they do that? I completely see how they can annihilate millions of people, because they don't consider those people to be of any importance, significance, intelligence, or able to contribute in any major way. And that's the reason, that's the thinking.
That's right. And these people that I refer to as the architects of control that operate on this level, who do play the geopolitical game just like a game of chess, understand that there are pawns on that game board, and that those pawns, you know, are sacrificial. Because, you see, they don't rule out the fact that even they can, at periods of time, be sacrificed. It's simple to understand everything about the world order, and very much it's very easy to understand what motivates these people when you absolutely, and I mean absolutely, just like William Burroughs had done, the great author, and like Sigmund Freud had already established, these people are psychopathic. They are very deeply disturbed. In my work, what I show, and so once you understand this, you don't, you know, argle bargle forth about, you know, their deeds. You understand that these people need to be locked up, or, you know, they shouldn't be in power, but we have a strange culture in our society, in our societies, in which they're rotten instead of cream floating to the top.
People put themselves in power.
Yeah, you know, they because remember, they're ruthless, and they serve ruthless entities, so they get to the top. And we have to set, you know, things in. We have to set things in place which prevent this. Now, in my work, you see, I always go into this. I always refer back to this point, that it is the insanity of these people that allow them to work this way, and that they make the world in their own image. And this includes slaughter, and this includes ecocide, and this includes misogyny, and this includes the level racism that has always plagued our world. That's coming from their brain. They are the thinkers whose hands then move to create the world systems, and we live in their forensic filth. And their origins and their beginnings does, in fact, go very far back. People would doubt that. People say, well, how can that be? Well, we have to understand that that is, in fact, the case. And it can be proven, it has been proven, that either ideologically, meaning they believe the same things, just like the neocons can be traced back to the philosophy of Leo Strauss, they can be traced back to the British Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, that themselves can be traced back to the Royal Institute of International Affairs, that itself has links, you see, to the Frankfurt School of Germany, that itself has links back even further to that, to other philosophies and ideologies. You see, everything can be traced back. Everything has a history. So just in the same way that a forensic scientist or detective can trace back a criminal's activities or actions in order to expose that person, this is very much the similar process. It's just that the theater on which this is done is the theater of history, in which we track back these universal criminals down through history, their trail, you see, the trail that they've left. And that's the most fascinating subject. And when you asked earlier, you see, that it seems so overwhelming to people, and where do you start? I have something to say about that. The difficulty arises not because the subject itself is difficult, but that so many people who haven't bothered to study this deeply then go along to write books, appear on television, mm-hmm. create CDs, DVDs, documentaries, etc. I'm ultimately glad that something is out there better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I'm censoring or want to cull, you know, or curtail anyone's creative efforts in this matter. But you see, there is a downside to that. There's a downside, unfortunately, to all the blogs and the websites and the mm-hmm. little conspiratorial, you know, little fringe philosophies and groups and all of this nonsense. And that is that it can seem overwhelming, and you're picking up a lot of threads, most of which, and I mean most of which, almost 99% of them, will lead you up a blind alley because they're written by people who haven't spent the time to study, like I have studied, and like my mentors have studied, you see, like mm-hmm. people like Jordan Maxwell and Dr. Coleman mm-hmm. and Eustace Mullins. So there is an intelligentsia within the conspiracy movement that you need to know about. It's like anything, you've got to get your hands around the information, but for goodness sake, try to go to those people who have credibility and who've put the time into it, rather than just some spin doctor who's bandwagon jumped into the subject, you know, and thinks they know all about it. And maybe have a publishing deal or whatever, and then they turn up on Oprah Winfrey tomorrow or whatever. You know, we've got to watch out for that, because as well-meaning as that is, it can also have a downside. This is not something that can be grasped in a second. It's not about label reading. It's about a tremendous study, a historical study of history, looking at very broad spectrum things. And that's why there's a great danger of either limited knowledge being put out into the world, and that limited knowledge not only frustrating people, I mean, that's one thing that it can do, because they just simply can't work out all the different conundrums. It's also capable of creating more prejudices and more limitations of its own. A lot of the literature that's put out, you see, will put Jews against Christians, or Muslims against, Jews, or whatever. It will, in fact, enforce a lot of this, sometimes meaningfully, deliberately, sometimes not deliberately. So that also has to be watched out for, because they're not aware, maybe, of the deeper reasons. So there's so much stuff out there, you see, accusing Jewish people. There's so much out there accusing, you know, the Roman Catholics. There's so much out there accusing, you know, secret societies, Illuminatis, etc., which is, all these words sound fine, but maybe they're not defined correctly. Even there's a lot of work out there, you know, pointing to who's in charge of this, you know, world order or whatever. And you might think this is wonderful, you found a true piece of it, and then you go down a certain amount of time and you find out it doesn't answer anything. It's only made you harder, it's only made you more limited in your knowledge, and it's made you, you know, more prejudiced. So it takes a great love, and it takes a great patience and a time to really get all the threads together and see where they lead.
Tons of distortion. I mean, exactly what you're saying. So much distortion. And because people don't do their research, it actually ends up supporting the other side, the side that you think you're trying to run away from. It's actually making it stronger, because there's so much distortion, so much misinformation. And unfortunately, those are the people that end up with these big book deals and on television.
I'm glad you brought that up. And you see,
there's
the average
reason for it.
Well, right. The publishing houses of the world, especially those in Britain and America, are run by the same, Zionist orders and Masonic orders that we're talking about. So are the newspapers and major magazines. Time, t- Time magazine, one of the most famous magazines in America. It was created by Henry Luce, who was, if I'm not mistaken, a sovereign knight of Malta, if not also a Freemason, taking his orders from the Black Pope. And these are the same, you know, entities who control the American government. So, of course, you have to be very careful when you turn to literature. You have to be careful even when you turn to my stuff. First of all, I don't have all the facts, you know, and I've got areas which a lot of people may say, you know, can't handle, or, you know, he's not right there. I'm open to that, because I am just, again, seeking myself. I'm a searcher, and I'm continually revising areas of what I've understood, but I'm just, you know, offering the fruits of my research, but I'm not there saying I have the only understanding in this. You know, it's people who may follow me, who may even perfect my work later on after I'm gone, you know. So we have to look at the continuum here, that this is an ongoing process even of discovery, because mankind is only literate a very recent amount of time. In fact, most people in the world are still in an illiterate state. The rest of them are so, you know, brainwashed, they don't even want to understand these new discoveries and findings. So there's a process. There's a process that's going on. No, I just wanted to emphasize the fact that, yes, the secret societies have their own writers, just like they show in the movie 3 Days of the Condor, you know, with Robert Redford, that there are groups within the secret services who actually are, their job is to write books and to write passages and to get onto chat rooms and to create websites to debunk and also to put out red herrings and to send people off in wrong directions, to exhaust time. To redirect them, exactly. This has happened in my life, you know, where we've had this onslaught, and of course it's happened to, you know, other people that we work in this community, where there's tons and tons of disinformation. You know, first of all, I object to the fact that a lot of people out there think we're perfect or something, so the slightest, you know, little flaw on us, you know, is suddenly meant to be exposed. You got to start talking about it. Like, where did you ever get the idea we're perfect in the first place? That this is annoying. But more importantly, you know, there is a tremendous backlash against the work that people like myself do. Not that it worries me in the slightest, I might add, but it does exist, you know.
I completely understand. And I think, you know, for what I do, for the work that I do, because I write, you know, quite a bit, and research as well. But a lot of what I write from a space of intuition and knowing, and of course then I connect that with information like yours, which then supports what I feel. And I do know that everyone has an ability to go really beyond the physical, beyond just looking at words, beyond all of that. I think if we start doing that, I think we will find out that we really will be guided and more directed towards a truth. You know, truth is forever unfolding. It's always going to another level and another level. But there is that connection that we have to remember that exists, and that is not emphasized. There is a question that just came in. And the question is, I think it's from Joe Anderson. So what can we do about it?
Well, first of all, he's asking me, so I can only answer from my particular, you know, level of understanding, is that his question is already invalidated, in my opinion, by the fact that he uses the word we. Okay, to me, I don't just come from the, you know, conspiratorial movement. I come from the metaphysical community, or metaphysical background, let's say, a philosophical background. And in that particular perspective, I mean, he's free to consult others, and they'll give him a different, you know, answer. But to me, in the spiritual, metaphysical, shamanic tradition, the words we, our, and us are invalid. They have no meaning whatsoever. Because once you're into that, I mean, and I'm talking within reason. Of course, there are many things that the collective can do and should do. But ultimately, I'm talking ultimately here, they have no validity. And that is because they immediately pull you into the political world, and I mean that with capitals, political, you see, the whole geopolitical world of waving placards, of hustling and fighting and bickering within that pigsty that has been created by our masters to vent off the very ardors and, violent passive-aggressive urges or whatever that they understand, for generations they've understood, will arise in people given the mediocrity of their lives, you see, and the control that is both liminally and subliminally imposed upon them. They haven't got the perfect slave robot yet. They have had periods of rebellion. They have had periods of great unrest, particularly when, for instance, you know, men came back from the First and Second World War, only to find out that these lords and ladies were still living and up sipping champagne in the vast estates of the world, while the Irish, you know, and Scots and Welsh people and the poor English were still slaving in their own, in their kitchens, or slaving in the slums, coming back to where half the villages or more are wiped out, where most of the men are wiped out. So they had waves of rebellion. They had waves of people like the Jarrow Marches, you see, of England, and the rising of the so-called working class, and they had to appease that. And so they were able to appease it by, you know, creating, allowing the creation of socialist movements. They opened the first trade unions, and they gave people a quote-unquote, what? What did they give them? They gave them a labor government. They gave them a democratic party. And people have to track back the history of those parties to find out that they're just as controlled by the same royal figures as the so-called conservatives on the other side, you see. So what I'm trying to say is that these people have manufactured and created the entire political, religious milieu in which they're hoping that you will dive into that, into the charities and into the whole political pigsty that they have manufactured. And, of course, they do allow you to have a few successes. Man is pretty much an imbecile. He's only semi-literate in the last, you know, 50 or something years. So you give a man, a political person, personal, first of all, you give him a lot of personal privileges. Secondly, you give him a certain amount of feeling of success. The British comedy called, you know, Yes, Prime Minister brings this out very beautifully, and many other movies have done this as well. Different movies that have been made on the presidency in America, you know, like these People's Champions films made by Robert Redford and others, where they do show you this sort of thing where a few successes, a few relative reforms within society, you know, like, for instance, you know, the slavery issue and other things, this is a tremendous boost forward for a lot of people. And if you can have these little reforms and your name can go down in the history books and your work has gone down in the minutes, this can give you the illusion that real change has taken place. People like myself are dead suspicious of that. It's not that we're saying you shouldn't have, you know, collective movements that do reform things on the local level. Of course you should. But let's see that in its true perspective. That is not going to change the status quo of what we are talking about when we talk about the, you know, the architecture of evil that stretches up to the top of the pyramid of control. So what the questioner has to understand is that the we has to be subdivided from the I. The real change that takes place in this world is an absolutely private study. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to do with we. This is a cop-out often. In my work, I consider it a complete, and I'm not accusing the questioner here. He is the absolute right, and he did well by questioning. But let's understand this very clearly, that until people start understanding that the we is one set of action, and that the I is another set of action, and first of all, you even have to discover the I, you have to discover the power of the self. You've got to start thinking about yourself as opposed to your duties to other people. Because if you're not concerned about the self, and if you haven't centered the self, and if you haven't enlightened the self, then that's like taking an oily rag to clean a clean window and then wondering why you can't see the garden. If you, as a toxic, repressed, suppressed, semi-literate, semi-knowledgeable, you see, anxiety-ridden individual, gets it into your mind one day that you can go out there and assist the world and other people, then I don't know, that's a form of psychopathy. Having done no inner homework, having done no, you know, yeah, exactly, any, you're not hygienic yourself in any strength of the imagination, but you mean well. We're not talking about that you don't mean well or that your objectives aren't good, and we're not even saying that you won't have a lot of successes for the history books. All of those true things are true. But nothing in the greater sphere of understanding will change, and the reason is this, that you do not have the condonement of the higher force. Some people want to call that God, go ahead. Want to call it the higher self, whatever, fine. That higher energy in the universe, which has created everything and which monitors everything and which is the supreme intelligence of the universe, is not necessarily going to condone your limited actions within the sphere of time that you just happen to think is very ego-satisfying for yourself. Mm-hmm. That you do get a lot of good out of it, and maybe there's some bad. You know, this is the normal ego-driven motives that move most of the corporate people, that very much are behind a lot of the political people, who are good people. They've read about the injustices of the world. They cannot sit before they're doing something about it. They must get into politics. They must do something about it, and they run out the door and join the Green Party, and they're going to join that party, and they're going to wave that placard, and they're going to speak from this place. But you see, what they don't understand is there's much greater rules. There's underlying rules to the progress and evolution of the human race. And a lot of this well-meaning, ego-satisfying level or sphere of activity needs to be understood in its context. There is a higher form of understanding. So it comes to the person. It comes to their personal level of spiritual and moral hygiene, which is, in other words, it starts at home. It starts within the self. And it starts within the discovery of who a man is, and more specifically, what it is within us, within the human being, within each person, that causes tyranny to exist or to come into being outside. Be that tyranny that you've experienced in your own family, or in your own relationships, or at your place of work, and then up to the corridors of power. This is what we, you know, and so really I address that question always, as I do most things, in a psychological rather than a political context. I don't rule politics out, but I see that everything that is manifested in the world, you see, is a manifestation of consciousness and of thinking. Now, my then question is much more along these lines. If our thinking has been manufactured for us, if our consciousness has been manipulated, then how can we trust our own thinking? That's another element, you see. So in my work, we're always pointing to these two forms of control. That the individual themselves is unempowered, disempowered, but then wants to bolster his feeling of littleness and emptiness by various political types of action. Because in the sphere of his own life, that makes him feel like a great, you know, hero or whatever. On the other side, he's got this unseen hand that also works to keep him in that illiterate, depressed, semi-literate, you see, fallen state. So I do not blame the average person for their actions because I realize that they're on strings. I understand why people are in these escapisms, in these illusions, thinking that tomorrow if only we can wake up all the people, then great change will happen, etc. I understand why these delusions exist in people's minds. It's because they've been brainwashed through centuries to believe this kind of thing. And they've been slowly moved off kilter, out of the real matrix of power.
They've been moved away from themselves. Absolutely.
That's it.
They've been moved away from themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I agree with you, Michael.
And I believe that a group of people, and we can change this now because we have internet and we have new technologies to help us with this, because it's not the days when, for instance, if ever that was going to make change, waving placards and joining political movements, don't you think that it already would have changed the world by now? It has done nothing. It really, what it does is it moves the furniture on the Titanic. And that might be a very productive thing to everybody doing that, moving the furniture, except to the guy who's on the the lookout post, who's looking at the iceberg coming ahead, screaming, "Don, will you stop moving the furniture? Because it don't mean a thing. We're going to hit the iceberg." So this is where the dichotomy is. To the people moving the furniture, hey, this is great fun. It needs to be done. It's going to be for the best. But when the entire ship of state is heading for oblivion, which is either the dystopia we were talking about at 2012 coming, or a new world order or whatever, you see, or the abandonment simply the entropy, simply the implosion of all the political and sociological idioms that we know, whatever is waiting for us. But that ship of state is in a perilous ocean. And so you may, you know, be distracting yourself by all this shenanigans and revelry and all of this allegiances. And as I'm saying, it's, you know, spend it within context. Of course you must address also these street level, reforms. It's very important to do that. But never think for a moment. And the most important thing is don't immerse yourself in that to the extent where you forget about your reason for being on this planet. You're here for 60 or 70 summers, some people less, some people a bit more. You have a very limited life in order to discover the meaning of life. And so you have to realize that you're also a guest on this planet and that your duty is to leave it in a better condition than when you found it. So, and then, of course, trying to do that, as we said, is problematic because you may be thinking that you're doing a lot of good, but it may turn out you do a colossal amount of evil, in fact. So it takes a great deal of education before a man or a woman can even begin to contribute to world reform. They have to get their own thinking into absolute, you know,
yeah,
sharpness.
Absolutely, Michael, and I think that's key. I think first you have to realize that you've been living a programmed life and that you've been living someone else's creation. I think that is one of the first things that we have to come to realization with. And when you are still tied into someone else telling you what you should believe, whether, you know, a religious organization or any organization that is compacted a set of beliefs for you, that's your first clue. And anything that you are having to worship, that's also another clue. So, Michael, you said it well. It begins within, and it's the individual. It has to be you. You and only you can get your guidance and direction outside of or beyond the confusion then, because there's a lot of distortions going on.
That's right.
Oh, Michael, there's just so many things. And the gentleman that asked the question, he actually, and additional to that, people of color, since we do not have power, do we need to do a Nat Turner to the system? I think you already answered that question.
Well, his well-meaning as his point is, he is now a product. His question is born from that divisiveness that is already part of the programming.
Yeah.
You know, by seeing himself as a minority or seeing himself as a political demographic, you see, these are definitions that only refer to your political number as the cattle in a different pen. I'm talking about humanness, which goes beyond color, which goes beyond caste. You know, I'm talking about the universal teachings of the elders, where these things were absolutely of not of importance. One, you may want to change your status, your rank, within the cattle pen that the masters have made for all the different, you know, sheep and hens and pigs and screaming geese and all of this. But we have to break out of that. We've got to question what that's all about and leave those prejudices behind and discover what it is to be human as opposed to be, you know, a different sort of status, a different category of employee within the giant pyramid of control. You know, again,
well, that's what it is, categories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it, categories. And trying to change your status within the status quo, within that black pyramid of power, that treacherous thing, I cannot look at and say, you know, is that, has any real total importance ultimately. You know, people may want to do that because they want to do it for whatever reason. But then don't put that in front of me as being the real, you know, the real weapons against this tyranny that has been oppressing all people, be they of any color, you know.
Well, that's the thing, you know, the whole process here, though, we only have about 3 minutes left, but the whole process here is to get you to never really realize exactly what Michael just said. You, as an individual, as a divine spirit, a divine, having your own divine connection, is to get you away from that. So all the categories have been created, and that's what we live in. We live based on categories in every which way possible. And when you're living on categories, what happens is you're fractured. You're so separated that it's very difficult. It's very easy to keep intercepting the or inserting the deceptions. So to find out who you are, as Michael said, is definitely the biggest key. Michael, an hour goes by so fast, and I would love to talk to you more, but now we're out of time. And I just want to say thank you to the listening audience, and again, thank you, Michael. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Would you please give your information out again?
Sure. Thank you, Sonia. Great interview again. People can contact me, you know, or look at my websites, and by going to michaeltessarian.com, just go to the main navigation page there, and if they want to make comments, they can come on my forum, which is there's a link to the forum. People can, you know, we get members from all over the world on the forum, and they can come and browse links and find out more, and also leave their own personal comments, you know, and get responses. We have our own forum right there for people. And again, just to end with, it's very, very important that people do realize that these demarcations are manufactured for them. And that another level of this, it ties into it, is the police yourself energy, which the controllers want. They're not in your life directly every day. What they do is they hope that you will start to police your own thoughts, that you will start to think of yourself in the way that they've, you know, created these, as you say, demarcations, these molds for you to fit in. And then from within those molds, you begin to police and organize your own life according to principles that they actually, that serve them in the long run. So it's a totally different matter of free thinking to unattach your mind from all of this kind of thing. And it takes a period of time to even do that so that you can see the amazing intricacy of the web of control that exists around human beings. It has many facets, both psychological and physical.
Well, thank you again, Michael, and I encourage the audience to please go to Michael's website. He has tons of information and videos. And also visit my website at www.spiritinform.com. Tons of information there as well. You may also contact me at Sonia at newcorporatebody.com. My phone number, 949-249-3825. And remember that the power to be a sovereign mind, a free mind, lies within you. Join me next week, same time.
Everybody put your hands together right here. Yeah, that's it.
Someday I will move on, be to the other side.